Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The rise of science and its relation to religion. That's the subject and the title. In my experience, I ignore whether your experience is the same. Today, there is often an unguaranteed belief that science is the enemy of religion. There is also a tendency to consider as religious any thought that makes explicit that God is the ultimate metaphysical ground for rationality. Not rarely, the supposed enmity between science and religion has led to the expulsion of God and Providence from the academic world. At bottom, there has been a conquest of the contemporary academic mind by atheistic, deistic, or agnostic philosophies, or at least the appearance of such a conquest. I say at least the appearance because the truth is that an important part of academics does not agree with the implicit anti-religious dogmas. Analytic philosophy of religion has amply shown that a not inconsiderable mass of philosophers rationally rejects them. I am sure that the same is true of many natural scientists and mathematicians, although the impoverishment of philosophical training and the virtual disappearance of classical training has deprived many of them of adequate intellectual tools to express their dissatisfaction. Today, I do not want to explore this sociological subject, but I want to rather contribute to the destruction of the historiographical mythology on which the aforementioned dogmas rest. In order to achieve this, I want to focus on how historically the main principles and forms and methods of science always emerged or were transmitted in the context of a religious atmosphere. And I will argue that this has been the case due to structural reasons, not due to mere coincidences. One, the emergence of science and philosophy in Greece. As is well known, science proper arose in Greece. What happened there was that for the first time, man tried to formulate demonstrations in the strict sense of the word. Many other peoples knew important mathematical or astronomical truths, but only the Greeks undertook the task of breaking them down into their principles and demonstrating them. Thales? Thales? Thales of Miletus, in devising the theorem of the triangle, conceived in his mind a seed which later grew into the beautiful tree of science. But in accomplishing this feat, the Greek mind at once tried to apply to other areas of knowledge and reality an analogous decomposition or resolution. As Aristotle says in his magnificent history of philosophy, the Greeks began to search for the archai, the principles of everything. At the start of this search, the philosophical mind could conceive of no principles of physical reality other than the sensible ones. But simultaneously, speculations that Aristotle himself called theological played a role in the mind of these early philosophers, which was thus flooded with two streams of light, the mythic speculative and the philosophical. We can understand this phenomenon with Erich Fegelin as a certain compactness of the theory. Thales tells us at the same time that water is the arche, the principle, and of reality, and that the world is full of gods. So it's strange because he has like a materialist hypothesis, but he says that the world is full of gods at the same time. The ascent to a kind of arche or physical reality, a kind of principle of physical reality, that is not sensible, is slow and painful in Greece. Gradually, the philosophical mind rises to suprasensible spiritual realities and realizes that mythical speculations do not adequately express the nature of principles. Xenophanes is an important milestone on this path of ascent. Parmenides and Heraclitus, the Pythagoreans, are other milestones. But following Aristotle again, we can say that the discovery of spiritual realities must be attributed more properly to Plato. It was this philosopher who came to introduce as the ultimate causal explanation, one, the suprasensual substances, the ideas, two, God, and three, what Aristotle will call matter. Plato called it hora, so something like space or place. It was he who coined the term theology, Plato. The theology is a word that Plato coined, not the Jews. It was Plato who did it. He coined the term theology for the study of the first principles of the cosmos, and it was he who conceived a systematic organization of the body of sciences in general and of each science in particular. Pierre Duhem, a historian of philosophy of the beginning of the 20th century, in The Aim and Structure of Physical Theories, has shown that it was in the academy that physical theory proper arose. That is, a mathematical explanation of phenomena which attempts to save them. And those first theories were geometric astronomical theories. It was in this school where the sphericity of the earth came to be known with certainty, the Academy of Plato. Aristotle, who was a member of Plato's Academy, proves it with various arguments and moreover gives us for the first time an exact measure of its perimeter. It was precisely Aristotle who best expressed, corrected, and developed all the achievements of the Academy regarding the reflection on the natural method of the sciences already practiced by the Greeks for a couple of centuries. In his posterior analytics and in the metaphysics, particularly in Book 6, Chapter 1, he formulates precisely what science is, what are the types of science, and what are the relations between them. Thus, for example, he tells us what a demonstration is and what are the main types of demonstration, from effects to causes and from causes to effects. He also tells us what the elements of a science are, the principles, which are definitions, postulates, and axioms, and he tells us how each of them is known or how each of them is formulated. Furthermore, he devises an outline of the organic body of the theoretical sciences. Each discipline has a subject genus on which its mode of abstraction, its method, and its precision depend. There are pure disciplines and mixed disciplines, half physical, half mathematical, and there are subalternating and subalternated disciplines, classification that depends on the way of knowing the principles of each one. For example, astronomy in the Academy was subject to geometry because the astronomical hypotheses were geometrical, or optics is subject to geometry too because the hypotheses in optics are subject to geometry. Okay, in this body of disciplines, the summit or the base, depending on how one looks at it, is occupied by theology. See text one in the handout. The text one in the handout shows that. I'm not going to read it now, but you can see afterward. And Platonic Aristotelian theology came to demonstrate the existence of God as the efficient cause of the cosmos, its highest good, and its ruler through an effective providence and care over it. Aristotle's studies on the structure of science yielded a powerful fruit very soon, which followed exactly the Aristotelian program, Euclid's Elements of Geometry. So Aristotle wrote the Posterior Analytics in 335, and the Elements were written in 310, something like that, following clearly the Posterior Analytics. In the course of more than two millennia up to the 19th century, many other scientific breakthroughs have had Aristotle's Posterior Analytics as their guidance. The whole Byzantine and Roman Christian scientific program, on which the Muslim program depends, the scholastic scientific program, on which the modern program depends, Galileo's reform of the scholastic program, and the program of non-Euclidean geometries, explicitly in Gauss and Riemann, all of them have used for their guidance the admirable work of the stagirite of Aristotle, the Posterior Analytics. This means that science emerged in a theological context, because Aristotle was a theologian, explicitly. In fact, the existence of properly spiritual realities was not even an explicit teaching of the Hebrew Bible until the Israelites came into contact with the Greeks after the conquests of Alexander the Great. It is in the biblical wisdom books, or in the Maccabees, or in the New Testament, that the conception of spiritual realities appears in the Bible with clarity, and it was taken from the Greeks. One of the most interesting insights of Greek philosophy is that the theoretical disciplines are interconnected and that the first principles are presupposed by all other disciplines except first philosophy or theology. Indeed, according to Aristotle, the examination of the archai of reality and of thought belong to the same discipline, theology. That's science among the Greeks. Two, the reception and development of science in the West. In the Metaphysics, Aristotle states that geometry developed in Egypt thanks to the leisure, scholé, enjoyed by the Egyptian priests. The alternative theory is that geometry was born out of the need to measure the land after the yearly flooding of the Nile. So the Nile every year flooded the land, and after the Nile retreated, there was a huge mess. Like, whose was this piece of land and whose was that? So you needed to know geometry to divide, to know how the division was. So some people say that for that reason, the Egyptians developed geometry. Aristotle says that the Egyptians developed geometry because the priests had leisure. Okay. Is science the fruit of leisure or of necessity? In the case of Egypt, it is difficult to decide one way or the other. I think that both ways were combined. But we can't decide for lack of documents. But we have enough witnesses concerning how and why science was received and developed in Latin Christendom, so in the West. In the first volume of his book, Medieval and Early Modern Science, which is this one, but this is the Spanish translation, but there is an English version which I have in PDF, so I can send it to you. So in the first volume of his book, Medieval and Early Modern Science, A.C. Crombie shows that mathematics was received and developed in Latin Christendom. Crombie shows that mathematics was cultivated by the Benedictine monks around Bede the Venerable out of a cultic, not a pragmatic necessity. They wanted to calculate the date of Easter accurately, harmonizing the Hebrew and Julian calendars. From the 5th century on, Christendom was divided in two branches: Greek Christendom, which was Byzantium, and all the conquests that Byzantium made, and Western Christendom. Western Christendom spoke Latin, and that's what I call Latin Christendom. England was part of Latin Christendom. So in England, the Benedictine monks around Bede the Venerable cultivated mathematics in order to calculate the date of Easter, because they needed to harmonize the Hebrew calendar, which was lunar, with the Julian calendar, which was based on the sun. Okay. In other words, it was leisure and contemplation that led to the serious cultivation of mathematics. And it was this that made it possible for this science to be transmitted and for Europe to be prepared for the reception of Muslim and Jewish science in the 11th to 13th centuries. But then, in the context of the universities of teachers in the 13th century, 12th and 13th centuries, which arose from the heart of the church, not only were the fullness of Greek science and of Arabic and Jewish science assimilated, but other sciences appear largely unknown to the predecessors, and the sciences already cultivated by the Greeks reach the highest summits. So the universities are an institution that was founded in Europe in Latin Christendom in the 12th century, and it was the church that founded those institutions. Okay. In the first place, the clerics who were masters in the universities assimilated the science, and in so doing followed the program of the posterior analytics, as I have already said. Crombie has shown this admirably in his Robert Grosset Test and the Origins of Experimental Science, which is this book, which is an excellent book. I also have it in PDF. I don't know about intellectual rights, so we have to see that. But well, yeah. They are also in archive.org. Secondly, contrary to what the official historiography claims, not only is the church not the enemy of mathematized experimental science, but the latter also emerged, like the university, from the bosom of the church. Experimental science did not begin with Galileo, as is often said, but it began in 1230 with the work of Robert Grosseteste. I will cite a couple of passages from Crombie in which the novelty can be appreciated. So now I read two passages from this book, the title of which is Robert Grosseteste and the Origins of Experimental Science. And you have the passages in the handout, the second number in the handout. In natural science, Grosseteste held that in order to distinguish the true cause from all possible causes at the end of composition must come a process of experimental verification and falsification. A theory reached by resolution and intuition was, as he pointed out, capable of yielding by deduction consequences beyond the original facts on which the induction was based. For, and this is a literal citation from Grosseteste. For when the argument proceeds by composition from principles to conclusions, it may proceed to infinity by the addition of the minor extreme under the middle term. End of the literal citation from Grosseteste. On the basis of these consequences, controlled experiments were arranged by which false causes could be eliminated. The investigator could then entertain as the true cause that which was left after all the other possibilities had, after all other possibilities had been eliminated. That is one text. The second text in the same handout reads, by means of mathematical aspects of looks, Grosseteste held that it was possible to explain qualitative differences in physical powers as arising from quantitative differences based on geometrical structure. Such a view of things led him to attempt to explain the intensity of heat and light as due to the concentration of rays, and heat itself as scattering of molecular parts due to movement. That's very interesting. Okay, end of the second text of the handout. There are two aspects to be separated here. On the one hand, the introduction of experimental research, of which there are precedents in Avicenna and other authors. Grosseteste, however, used it for the first time systematically. Moreover, in this he goes farther than Aristotle and other Aristotelians. It is not just a matter of being closely bound to experience, but of making deductions from hypotheses and then designing experiments to rule out false hypotheses. This can be done within the sciences that Maritain called empirical schematics, such as physiology, or within all types of sciences. This is where the second point fits. So I'm going to read in a moment. But you see, if this is not experimental science, I don't know what experimental science is. So you have hypotheses, you make deductions, and then you design experiments to see that if they match the deductions, and in that way you confirm the hypothesis. That's experimental science. That's what Grosseteste created, invented, in 1230. The use of mathematical hypotheses in the investigation of various aspects of physics is to a large extent a novelty, or at least the systematic use of these hypotheses is something new. To understand the implications of this phenomenon, it becomes necessary to develop a metaphysical distinction that appears in the work of St. Thomas, but there is not enough time except to just mention it. And this is the third text in the handout. This is a citation from the Summa Theologiae. Reason may be employed in two ways to establish a point. Firstly, for the purpose of furnishing sufficient proof of some principle, as in natural science, where sufficient proof can be brought to show that the movement of the heavens is always of uniform velocity. Reason is employed in another way, not as furnishing a sufficient proof of a principle, but as confirming an already established principle by showing the congruity of its results, as in astrology, the theory of eccentrics and epicycles, which is Ptolemy's astronomy, is considered as established because thereby the sensible appearances of the heavenly movements can be explained. Not, however, as if These proofs were sufficient for as much as some other theory might explain them. So, mathematical hypotheses save the phenomena, but they might be defeated if another hypothesis saves the phenomena in a better way. That's what this text is saying. In mathematical physics, hypotheses in principle save phenomena, but they cannot be definitively proved, thought Aquinas, right? It is otherwise in causal natural science. It is very difficult to falsify, for example, that blood leaves the heart when it contracts, as Harvey proved against Descartes. Descartes thought that the blood left the heart when it expanded. And Harvey said, no, you are wrong. It leaves the heart when it contracts. And he proved it experimentally. Okay. Thirdly, Robert Grosseteste was not an isolated genius, but rather one of the initiators of the tradition of scholastic science. This science was developed above all at the university. We must say two words about this institution. The university emerged from the bosom of the church. This is not accidental. The church represents one of the faces of the supra-utilitarian dimension of human nature, as the university represents the other. A society in which religion is valued is a society in which the supra-utilitarian is valued. This is one of the reasons why Catholic society was a suitable environment for the cultivation of science. The church as an institution in particular represents a differentiation of human activity that took place in Israel and Judah, where the prophets were counterweights to the king's power. Such a differentiation was parallel to that occurred with Socrates between political power on the one hand and philosophy on the other, or between prudence and wisdom. The prophetic mission of the Old Testament was inherited by the church. It materialized around the words of Christ, "Render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's." In Latin Christendom, it finally crystallized in the secular power spiritual power tension, embodied in the emperor-pope tension. The West enjoyed greater freedom than the Christian East and Byzantium, because in the West, there was no Caesar papism among the Latins. The spirit was free to investigate the truth of things without being coerced by secular or political power. In Byzantium, the emperor really defined what the patriarch believed. Exactly for this reason, the university, more precisely the public university, which was the only kind existing, was born endowed with autonomy. Autonomy consisted of financial autonomy achieved thanks to the endowments, the universities had rental assets, academic autonomy, which consisted in the freedom to choose the members of the faculty, students, professors, in the freedom to teach the different disciplines as the masters thought fit, and to award degrees and in full freedom of research, and administrative autonomy, which consisted in the power of self-organize and to control its own administration. At the beginning, the University of Paris clashed with the local bishop, but was protected by the Pope. The University of Oxford clashed with the local secular authorities, but was protected by a papal legate and the Bishop of Lincoln, who was Grosseteste, the same that I mentioned before. So the University of Professor was not only born out of the bosom of the church, but its autonomy was protected by the Catholic hierarchy. On the autonomy of universities, see the book by Robert Reid, Life in the Medieval University, to which you have a link on the handout number 4. It's a very interesting short book, which is in Gutenberg Project. You can find it there. In a way similar to that of Plato's Academy, the university sought knowledge for knowledge's sake, and there was a body of knowledge that aimed at encompassing the whole of reality, a body crowned by theology. Because of this search for knowledge for its own sake, experimental science, wrongly called modern, was born in its midst in 1230. Precisely from the work of the Bishop of Lincoln, Robert Grosseteste, came experimental science long before Galileo, 400 years, actually. Therefore, like Greek science, Western science was born in the context of religious thought, in the sense in which we have understood it. But so as a thought that conscious that God exists and is the foundation of the rational order of the cosmos. But we can go further. The theology that was cultivated at the university was not only Greek natural theology, but supernatural theology, based on faith and revelation. Was the faith of Western scientists an accident peripheral to their scientific activity? That will be the fourth point that we will deal with. In the 12th century, the eruption of the fullness of Greek science clashed at first with traditional Augustinianism. But this clash could be assimilated precisely because wisdom was free from the control of political prudence and spiritual power was open to natural truth. St. Thomas achieved the most complete synthesis between Greek science and Catholic theology, as well as between reason and faith. But the attitude of St. Thomas simply expressed the intimate nature of the Church. Thus, although in 1277 some Averroist theses were condemned by the Bishop of Paris, this act did not bring research to a standstill. A parallel phenomenon happened in the Muslim world. In the Muslim world, Aristotelianism was condemned, so they stopped science. It stopped right there in the 13th century. Among the Jews, the same thing happened. Moses Maimonides was condemned, and there it stopped. That didn't happen in the Catholic Church. So in 1277, there was a condemnation of Averroist thesis. This act did not bring research to a standstill. As Pierre Duhem has shown in a work freely available on the internet, both in English and Spanish, is available his work. That act rather manifested the adherence of the faith over the philosophical tradition, and precisely because of that, it allowed astronomy and all physics to open up to horizons that the Averroists could not dream of, because those horizons surpassed Aristotle's knowledge. A particular example of what I mean is the statement contained in Bishop Tempierre's declaration, according to which the omnipotence of God cannot be conceived as limited to the creation of a single world with a single center of gravity. It was possible for there to be a plurality of centers to which the heavy bodies tended to fall, which was expressed as the existence of a plurality of worlds. This observation protected astronomical research from Averroist orthodoxy that threatened to set limits to the search for truth in astronomy. Moreover, it constituted an important step towards the discovery of gravity and the abandonment of geocentrism. I don't know if it's clear. So the Aristotelians thought that there was only one center of gravity, the center of the Earth. And they thought that whatever doctrine that contradicted that was false. And then the Franciscan especially said, that's not true, because God is omnipotent and he might create other centers of gravity. So there might be other, and they say God can create a plurality of worlds, meaning a plurality of centers of gravity. Well, that allowed the West to develop astronomy, breaking with Aristotle. Yeah. So it was precisely adherence to revealed truth that prevented Averroism from becoming an astronomical orthodoxy. It was what allowed Christian philosophers not to be indissolubly married to Aristotle, unlike Islamic philosophers. In other words, it was the faith that made modern astronomy possible. Fifth, all the foundations of modern science were developed by scholasticism. Galileo made important contributions, but much less than what is usually attributed to him. Let us make a brief enumeration of some of the medieval discoveries, and this is based mostly in Duhem's book that I mentioned and in this other book, Medieval and Early Modern Science, Volume 2. So the medieval discoveries are these. One, although it had presence in Philoponus, Avicenna, Avempace, Averroes, the application of algebra to dynamics became systematic only in the Latin university, starting in the 14th century. It was mainly due to Thomas Bradwardine and Gerard of Brussels. Two, the use of the notion of impetus, immediate presence of inertia, which was due to Philoponus and independently to Franciscus of the Marchia and Jean Buridan. Well, I can explain this in the quick Q&A questions, otherwise I won't finish. The discovery of the rotation of the Earth In the 14th century, Jean Buridan and the Bishop of Oresme explained day and night by means of the rotation of the earth, and this was the most widespread opinion in Spain, also in popular extracts or layers. For this reason, Núñez de Balboa, when he took possession in 1513 of the Pacific Ocean or the South Sea, did so in perpetuity, citation marks, for as long as the earth rotates. That's what he said. I take possession. He went to the ocean up to his knees, and then he took his sword and his secretary, and he sink his sword in the ocean, and he said, I took possession of this southern sea from one pole to the other, from one extreme to the other, blah, 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 in the name of my queen, Joan, and my king, Ferdinand, whatever, for all the duration of the earth. And then he used the expression, for as long as the earth rotates, because that's what they thought in the and he didn't know to write or read. So an analphabet thought that the earth rotates. Yeah. For the study of pre-Newtonian relativity of motion and spatial situation was first carried out by Oresme. 5, the imagination of a heliocentric system after Aristarchus belonged to Copernicus, who was a scholastic too, by the way. But he drew many principles from the previous scholastics. After Oresme proved that the rotation of the earth would produce the same phenomena than the rotation of the heavens around the earth, Nicholas of Cusa added a Platonic twist to Buridan's dynamics. And then I have a long literal citation of Nicholas of Cusa, which I should add to the handout, but I didn't. Sorry about it. Yeah. So here it comes. By attributing the permanence of celestial rotation to the perfect spherical form of the spheres. Nicholas of Cusa added a Platonic twist to Buridan dynamics. By attributing the permanence of celestial rotation to the perfect spherical form of the spheres. The circular movement of a sphere on its center would continue indefinitely, he said in his De Ludo Globi. And just as the movement given to the ball in a game of billiards would continue indefinitely if the ball were a perfect sphere, so God had only to give the celestial sphere its original impetus, and it has continued to rotate ever since and kept the other spheres in motion. This explanation was adapted by Copernicus for his system. By giving the earth and planets an annual motion around the sun, Copernicus offered a mathematical as well as physical alternative to Ptolemy. When he came to consider gravitation and the other physical problems involved, his work appears as a direct development of that of his predecessors. This is Crombie. This is Crombie, not Cusa. And I must remark, by the way, that neither Bishop Oresme nor the priest Copernicus had any problems with the church. 6, important progress in statics and optics. 7, accurate study of the fall of bodies. The correct formula to calculate the fall of bodies, is found for the first time in the work of the Spanish Dominican Domingo de Soto in the 16th century, in 1551. I know from experience that in particular point 7 is difficult to swallow because this discovery is usually ascribed to Galileo, the true founder of modern mechanics. For this reason, I will expand on it a little. In 1551, De Soto published his Questiones super octos libros Physicorum Aristotelis. In question 3, folio 92, column D, he formulates for the first time correctly the problem of the acceleration of falling great bodies, applying to them the Merton College theorem of average velocity. His exact words were that bodies fall with a uniformiter disformis motion. William Wallace, in his work The Enigma of Domingo de Soto, Uniformiter Disformis and Falling Bodies in Late Medieval Physics, has investigated the opinions of all the contemporary or earlier authors who dealt with this problem and has concluded that none had arrived at the correct formulation. It means uniform acceleration. For their part, Juan José Gómez Camacho and Ignacio Sols Lucía have shown with a great deal of evidence that Galileo most probably took from De Soto this correct formulation, which he did not know in 1604. In particular, they have pointed out that the Jesuit Gian Battista Riccioli used exactly the textual words of De Soto in 1629 when he was trying to carry out experiments that would allow him to establish the law of the fall of bodies. And then this is a literal citation that I should have also included in the handout, but I didn't. The best and most evident experiments show not only the inequality in the motion of heavy bodies, but the real increase of their velocities, increasing uniformiter, disformiter, towards the end of the motion. That's the phrase by the Jesuit guy, which is exactly De Soto's phrase. With this indication, they established, the Spanish authors, that the tradition that began with De Soto was firmly established in Italy, in the environment that Galileo frequented and respected. These same Spanish authors have shown very persuasively, moreover, that De Soto developed another crucial thesis, that of internal resistance to force, that is, that of inertial mass. This thesis was accepted 3 years later, or rediscovered by Giambattista Benedetti, and exerted an important influence on the Galilean discovery of inertia. As can be seen, actually, all the foundations of the misnamed modern science were laid by the clerics of the Latin universities. A.C. Crombie not only shows this, but also demonstrates that Galileo and other non-clerical scientists knew the works of the scholastics and followed them. He also demonstrates that when in the 15th and 16th centuries, the humanists clung to the classics, the scholastics despised them because scholastic science had surpassed the classical science by far. But today we know much more than this. The research by William Wallace, which is this book that I have here, and it's very hard to find. I will make a PDF, I think. The research by William Wallace, published in his book, Galileo and His Sources, allows us to be aware that the logical foundations of Galileo's new method were heavily influenced by the teachings of the Collegio Romano, so that the new science is, somewhat surprisingly, profoundly scholastic and Aristotelian. Somewhat surprisingly, because Galileo wrote this dialogue on the two new sciences, and there the stupid guy is Simplicio, who is an Aristotelian. So you say, well, how is it that he's an Aristotelian? Well, that would take a long time to explain, but Wallace proves what I'm going to say now. Let us summarize the main findings of Wallace's work. In the first place, he demonstrates that the national edition by Antonio Favaro of Galileo's works omitted, one, the manuscript fragments connected to the two new sciences, and two, several of the early Latin notebooks regarded by Favaro as irrelevant as scholastic exercise. He included one of the manuscripts among the Juvenilia, but Wallace has found that the first group of manuscripts proves that Galileo had completed most of his experimental work on which the new science of motion is based some 30 years before the publication of the two new sciences in 1638. The second group of manuscripts, moreover, do not belong to Galileo's student time, as Favaro thought, but are dated around 1590, when he was already teaching at the University of Pisa. Some of these notebooks were copied from the lecture notes of young Jesuit professors at the Collegio Romano. Moreover, citation marks, many of the terms and expressions he uses in these notebooks continue to recur in his later manuscripts and published writings, so much so that one may rightfully regard them as the heritage of the Collegio Romano, whose elements still survive in the Nuova Scienza of 1638. End of citation. In the second place, and very succinctly, a careful study of Galileo's earlier science up to 1609 and later science allows us to state that he introduced in them, even in its foundations, important, even central Aristotelian elements such as, one, the conception of the principles of science taken from posterior analytics, as this work was explained in the Collegio Romano. Two, the conception of scientific demonstration and its division in demonstration from the causes to the effects and demonstrations from the effects to the causes. Three, The distinction between physics and geometry regarding the kind of demonstration that these sciences use and regarding their certitude and the ruling of this distinction on the greater abstraction of mathematics. 4, the identification of the category of quality as extensive magnitude found in the continuum as the object of mathematics. Pardon, category of quantity as extensive magnitude, not quality, quantity as extensive magnitude. 5, the philosophical awareness that in the application of mathematics to physics, there are unavoidable imprecisions introduced by matter. And 6, the search for a causal explanation, which is what led him to abandon the Ptolemaic system and embrace the Copernican one. And this was the motive in Copernicus himself and in Kepler, by the way. I can explain this in the Q&A sessions too, if you remind me. But Galileo received this current of knowledge from the scholastics and gave to it a new impulse, effectively becoming the father of modern science. His main inventions are the following. 1, a remarkable improvement in the experimental methods that the scholastics were already using. 2, the effective reduction of the science of mechanics to a system of principles following the archetype proposed by posterior analytics. 3, the inclusion of astronomy in the science of mechanics. That was his greatest contribution, I think. 4, to achieve 2, he needed to be aware that physics is less precise than mathematics, and therefore that he needed to introduce suppositions so that any departures from mathematical rigor in their deduced consequences would be insensible in observation and experiment. 5, in the same line, Galileo, following Archimedes' example, used approximative techniques and made ample use of limit concepts, remaining always on the field of searching the real causes of mechanical phenomena and not just mathematical hypotheses that save the phenomena. A good instance of this Archimedean inclination can be found in the use by Galileo of rectangular figures instead of crude ones in his drawings of falling bodies, since the sphericity of the Earth can be neglected in the face of appropriate suppositions, because it's so big, the Earth, that he can represent it with parallelograms. The net result of Wallace's investigation in our current context is that Galileo, a religious man, not only was not opposed by the church qua scientist, but he received his basic scientific education from the scholastics, and the main tenets and even the main structure of his science has scholastic foundations, although he developed them considerably. So modern science is not the invention of Bacon and Descartes against the obscurantist philosophy and theology of the scholastics, but an offshoot of the science of the scholastics and the universities, where Galileo, by the way, was a professor when he laid the foundations for his developed science of mechanics. He was a professor at the University of Venice. After Galileo, it is true that European science was not exclusively Catholic and that it became slowly secularized. However, even later, many important scientists were religious men or women, lay or clerical. I do not want to descend now into these details. Instead, I want to make a philosophical turn, interrupting my historical overview. So now I stop the historical and then I go to philosophical reasons of the connection between science and religion. Plato and Aristotle realized that reflection on the principles of the science of the sciences is taken to the last consequences, pardon, if taken to the last consequences, leads immediately to realize that they cannot be the acts of a material organ. So they cannot be the acts of the brain, the understanding of the principles. Some modern neuroscientists have come to this amazing realization after decades of research on stimulation of the cerebral cortex with gentle electric discharges from an electrode. Penfield, for example, concluded that there is no place in the cerebral cortex where electrical stimulation will cause a patient to believe or to decide. That's Penfield, one of the greatest neuroscientists of the 20th century, after decades doing brain research that I can describe later. See text in number 5 of the handout, where Aristotle teaches that the pre-Socratics did not reflect well in first principles because they did not realize that intellectual knowledge is incorporeal. And the second text in the same number is by Penfield. Natural science and mathematics, in turn, deal with the being that is subject to movement and the abstract quantitative dimensions of bodily beings. Reflecting on the principles of particular sciences, therefore, leads to considering a reality that transcends particular sciences. This activity belongs for this reason to a higher discipline capable of considering non-bodily beings. What is this discipline? Aristotle gave three names to such disciplines. First, philosophy, wisdom, and theology. The subject matter of this discipline is being qua being, which can exist without matter, which can exist with matter or without matter. No science is real science if the basic tenets of this natural theology are denied. Why? Because neither natural science nor mathematics consider the what is, the essence, or the whether it is. For example, if you ask a mathematician what a prime number is and whether they are infinite, he will answer very competently. But if you ask him what numbers in general are and whether they exist in reality, he might give you an answer, but qua mathematician, he is not competent to answer the latter questions. Something analogous happens when you ask a physicist in what sense his formulae correspond with reality. He knows they do somehow, but although he is competent to find those formulae and understand their meaning and to apply them in experiments or observation, he is not equally competent, qua physicist, to answer such a question, in what sense the formulae correspond to reality. It turns out then that religion, in the sense of the theological discipline that considers immaterial beings and the first arche of the cosmos, is the necessary background in which science flourishes. John Henry Newman was very aware of this, as you can see in text number 6 of the handout that I'm not going to read. And if you reread in this light his book, The Idea of a University, you will see that this insight is one of the guiding principles of this fabulous book. That is why when theology is kicked out of the university, you know that something is wrong with the human search for knowledge. That is all. Before your questions, thank you. Yeah.
Oof. Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.